We don't often have running debates in this program. It's easier to do that in Life Matters or even The Science Show. But occasionally a response is fitting, such as today when Dr. Matthew Large responds to a critique of his work on pot. Specifically, the suggestion that rates of psychosis have gone up because more young folk are indulging. The argument against this being that so many all over the world are smoking joints, that you'd expect a gigantic surge of psychosis everywhere, and it seems there isn't one. So here's Dr. Large to introduce himself.
A disclosure first. I'm a middle-aged psychiatrist. I work in a psychiatric hospital, and I specialise in the treatment of psychosis, typically people with schizophrenia. I do some research. It's more than a hobby, but I'm paid to treat patients. I smoked pot a few times as a young person, and I didn't like it very much. Most of my patients are well most of the time. They are a very interesting and nice group of people, and I enjoy my work. Almost all of my patients have been delusional at one time or another. When they're delusional, they believe all sorts of unbelievable things. Delusions can be very unusual. Some believe they are God, others believe that their spouse has been replaced by a malicious imposter, or that they have a transmitter implanted in their brains. Less unusual delusions include having cancer, being poisoned, or ideas of being pursued by pedophiles, bikies, the CIA, or the mafia. Most of these delusions arise because of a combination of abnormalities of perception, such as hearing voices, and grossly illogical thinking. Delusions are often far-fetched, are not based on any real evidence, and can be complex and convoluted. William of Ockham, after whom this program is named, suggested we should provisionally accept the simplest complete explanation as the best explanation. My patients with psychosis just can't do this. They often go for the most complex and least likely theory, like an Occam's razor in reverse. Although it is possible to understand some patients' symptoms, why some people develop schizophrenia and others do not is a long-standing medical mystery. About half of the story is genetic, but we don't really know which genes are involved. Environmental factors matter. Infections, vitamin D, the stresses of child abuse or migration might all be important. However, on any given day, most of my hospitalised patients, and occasionally every one of my inpatients, has a history of long-term cannabis use. There is little doubt that there is some relationship between cannabis and psychosis. It is beliefs about cannabis and psychosis that I want to reflect on today. Paradoxically, I'm not so concerned with the views of my patients here. My patients and I rarely disagree about cannabis. Many know they are addicted and harmed. Some directly blame cannabis for their illness. It is beliefs about cannabis held by the non-mentally ill, on the internet and even on this program some weeks ago, that I've become interested in. In recent years, doctors and neuroscientists have become increasingly sure that cannabis can precipitate psychotic illness, such as schizophrenia. This is not proven, for nothing in science is ever really proven, but the evidence is really strong. The strongest evidence you could imagine would be to randomise people to smoke pot or not and follow them for 5 or more years looking for psychosis. This study will never be performed, and we have to make do with other data. It has long been known that people with schizophrenia are highly likely to smoke cannabis. This could be because it relieves their symptoms. However, this seems unlikely because patients almost invariably start smoking cannabis some years before they become psychotic, and most marijuana smokers who do develop psychosis quit smoking soon afterwards, presumably because they know it has made them ill. Furthermore, when you ask people with psychosis why they smoke, they will tell you it is to get high and not to treat their symptoms. Perhaps the most convincing evidence comes from prospective studies. In a landmark study of 45,000 otherwise well military conscripts, those who smoked cannabis were 6 times more likely to develop schizophrenia in the next 15 years. This study has been repeated nearly a dozen times, each time with a similar result. Furthermore, the more pot you smoke and the younger you are when you start, the greater the risk. Other studies have been more direct. If you inject Delta-9 THC, an active ingredient of cannabis, into volunteers, some become transiently psychotic. And cannabis users with psychotic experience have a higher ratio of Delta-9 THC to other cannabis compounds in their bodies. Our research group, that includes myself and Dr. Olaf Nielsen, from the University of New South Wales, Sydney, and Michael Compton from George Washington University, Washington DC, has taken a different approach. We have not looked at whether cannabis users develop psychosis, but when psychosis starts in cannabis and non-cannabis users. Over the years, some studies have suggested that people who smoke cannabis, who do develop psychosis, get sick at a younger age. But individual studies are often wrong. This is also a hard topic to research because people who smoke cannabis start young, and it is mainly young people who develop psychosis. We reanalyzed all of the earlier research on the topic, including unpublished data, and concluded that there is a genuine effect of cannabis bringing on earlier schizophrenia and other psychoses. We found that those who smoke cannabis who do develop psychosis become psychotic at an average of nearly 3 years earlier than other patients. Our research shows this is a very consistent finding, present in almost every study. More recently, we have shown that this is not true for tobacco users who do not have an earlier age of onset of psychosis. Our results show that there is something in cannabis smoke that is not in tobacco smoke that brings on schizophrenia earlier and, in all likelihood, brings on psychosis in some people who would otherwise be well. When our results came out in the Archives of General Psychiatry in February of 2011, there was a lot of media interest. I did little else but talk to journalists for a week. It even made Time magazine. Doubtless, some of the news stories were a little simplistic or even exaggerated, but the media cannot communicate every detail, and I was pleased with the coverage. However, other people were not so pleased, and I quickly became public enemy number one to those who advocate for the legalization of cannabis. I received numerous anonymous and critical emails and letters. Some were threatening. There were literally hundreds of rude and hostile posts on the internet, many by people known only by such names as Leaf Man, All Heads, or Hydro Boy. A couple of critics had the guts to use their real names, and I commend them for that, but I can't agree with them. For example, Peter Reynolds, the head of an English pro-cannabis political party, posted a picture of me with the clearly defamatory heading, "This man is not a scientist, he is a propagandist." On this program, a Dr. John Jiggins said something very similar. He described my study, and I quote, as tabloid science of the media, by the media and for the media. Science carried out through the newspapers and radio rather than the academic journals. Because it wasn't really science, merely entertainment involving science. End of quote. In fact, there was nothing unscientific about our study. It was driven by a specific hypothesis, was carefully planned and executed by a team of people, was mathematically analysed and written up, and the study was rigorously peer-reviewed. We declared our interests and sources of funding. We had none to declare, and some months later, a major scientific journal published our findings under our own names. When the study came out, we communicated our findings to a broader audience, including by YouTube. This is how science works. In contrast, Reynolds, Jiggins and others got their views aired on the basis of little other than their conviction that cannabis is safe. Jiggins, I admit, referred to one scientific study. Reynolds based his criticism of me solely on the assumption that I hold strong views that cannabis should be illegal. For the record, I don't think cannabis laws work so well. I am concerned if possession of a small amount of cannabis damages a person's life because of a criminal record. To my mind, the best arguments in favour of cannabis decriminalisation are civil liberties arguments. In a free society, people are generally free to do what they like, however foolish, as long as they understand what they are doing and nobody else gets hurt. I have now read literally hundreds of critical internet posts about myself and our cannabis research. I now think I understand some of the underlying reasons why some people can't accept that cannabis can be harmful. I don't think people's responses are just born of ignorance, nor are they simply an expression of the surprise and denial that can be associated with new knowledge. At base, a lot of people like dope. Saying pot is bad for you is like saying the Beatles were a terrible band. This liking for cannabis can be expressed in at least four types of argument. The first argument in favour of cannabis was run by Reynolds, who seems to believe that cannabis cannot be bad for you if it should be legal. Clearly, this makes no sense at all. but yet there is no doubt in my mind that this is a common reason to believe that cannabis is safe. It follows, using this logic, that any study finding that cannabis is harmful is really about prohibition and therefore must be wrong. The second argument is kind of simpler and runs like this. I smoke cannabis, I don't have schizophrenia, therefore cannabis does not cause schizophrenia. Many years ago I heard this argument from the father of an 11-year-old boy who had developed hallucinations and delusions. The father said to me, and again I quote, "Pot can't be bad 'cause Doc, me and my mate smoke twice as much as him," end quote. Jiggins, on this program, also objected to me highlighting the particular dangers of cannabis for children, bizarrely, on the grounds that alcohol holds similar dangers. Alcohol is certainly bad for children, but this does not make cannabis safe. This brings me to the third argument. Some people, including a person calling himself Mr. Drug Truth Australia, kindly emailed me their views. In a couple of singularly angry letters accusing me of being in the pay of Big Tobacco or the producers of alcohol, Drug Truth, or perhaps Mr. Australia, implied a third argument as well, that cannabis must be safe because alcohol and tobacco are dangerous. A ludicrous argument made repeatedly on the internet. The most frequent argument I have heard or read runs like this. You have no right to comment on cannabis because you don't smoke it. The corollary is, if you had inhaled, you would never say these nasty things about pot. Both are wonderful and presumptuous bits of pot-fueled logic. Finally, although this is not really an argument for cannabis, some cannabis lovers explain away any criticism of cannabis as the result of a cynical and well-oiled propaganda machine. This was the essence of Jiggins's essay, Reynolds' blog, and Mr. Drug Truth's anonymous letter. They imagine the producers of tobacco and alcohol in cahoots with conspirators in government and in the sciences. Well, frankly, I doubt it. And if these conspirators do exist, I have certainly never been asked to one of their secret meetings, nor have they paid me a cent. All of this has gotten me thinking about why people without psychosis believe what they believe. The ideas of William of Ockham do not seem to be terribly influential on the internet. Self-interest is a powerful force. The internet, particularly where cannabis is concerned, is also a medium for subculture, with lots of reinforcing communications between participants. Some groups of internet correspondents seem to be totally unable to conceive of themselves as being wrong. Others are probably just naturally optimistic and can't accept that some truths are inconvenient. As a species, perhaps we just have an inherent capacity for self-deception. Some commentators are simply stoned. Well, maybe my patients with their fantastic beliefs and often good-humoured suffering are not that much less rational than the rest of us after all. They are almost invariably more polite. Anyway, I will end here. I'm off to have a few beers with some climate scientists.
And I'm sure, Doctor, you'll drink responsibly. Dr. Matthew Large is Clinical Senior Lecturer in the School of Psychiatry, University of New South Wales, and of course in private practice. And you'll find our previous discussion about this topic at the Occam's Razor website, broadcast on August the 28th. Next week, still in the head, epilepsy. Have we improved treatment? I'm Robin Williams.